This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Think about the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He took office in the depths of the Great Depression and guided the country through the last days of World War II. But while FDR's first 100 days may be the most celebrated period of his presidency, the 18 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor proved to be the most critical.
I didn't realize until I did the research the extent to which the United States was really naked, militarily speaking, in the late spring and early summer of 1940.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll celebrate Independence Day with a trip back to history class and learn about the most important days of FDR. We'll also spend an academic minute understanding history by using math. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Franklin Roosevelt will long be remembered for his Herculean effort to bring the United States out of the Great Depression, his steadfast leadership during World War II, and for being the only president to serve more than two terms. But as David Kaiser argues, it was between the fall of France in June 1940 and the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, that Roosevelt made his greatest contribution to the course of American and world history. Kaiser writes about this in his new book, No End, Save Victory, How FDR Led the Nation into War. David Kaiser has taught history at Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, the Naval War College, and Williams College. He spoke to The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about why he chose to focus on this time in FDR's presidency.
Well, I've spent my life studying international politics and the origins of wars, so I knew this was a critical moment in world history. But I didn't realize until I did the research, two things. First of all, the extent to which the United States was really naked, militarily speaking, in the late spring and early summer of 1940, when France had fallen, when Britain was expected by just about everybody to be successfully invaded by Germany, and everybody, I think, includes Roosevelt, and when Japan then in September made an agreement with Germany to join in a war with the United States, if one took place. While we had one of the world's largest navies, it was not nearly large enough to face the situation that would arise if Britain were defeated. We had practically no army, and we had practically no air force, which was clearly now going to be a critical weapon. And what is incredible is that Roosevelt and the men around him, the men he brought into the government, including representatives of industry and labor, were able to do such extraordinary work and such extraordinary planning in the next 18 months that by the time of Pearl Harbor, we were not only planning for war, but we were planning for an unprecedented production effort to carry out a mission which Roosevelt had defined relatively recently, namely the complete defeat of all our possible enemies of both Germany and Japan.
One of the things that you write about in the book that is really interesting is that here was a president who believed that the involvement in this conflict was inevitable. And ultimately, you write about how he set up preparing the public for this, which was really interesting how he went about doing that.
Well, it is very interesting. And as you know, I quoted from a lot of his speeches, but I did that partly because I think they're wonderful, but partly to show the step-by-step way in which he did that. And it starts out in late summer 1937, when Japan is at war in China and things in Europe are threatening as well. And he gives the quarantine speech, as it's called, in Chicago, in which he says, the world is sinking into anarchy, aggressive states are run wild, and we cannot assume that this is not going to reach the Western Hemisphere without indicating what he has in mind. And it turns out he was willing to take some action against the Japanese if the British had gone along, but they wouldn't. So that's step one. Now, then, as France is falling in late May, he says, well, a lot of us have wanted to believe that we weren't threatened. I tried to point out that we were, but in any case, now we simply have to deal with this situation, and we're going to build 50,000 aircraft, And a month later, he proposes doubling the Navy, which is rushed through Congress. And a couple of months later, we put in a draft. But all the rhetoric until through 1940 is about defending the Western Hemisphere. And then you begin to see a shift at the turn of the year, and it's in the State of the Union that in January 41 that he says, not for the first time, that we're in a struggle to determine the fate of the world with these dictator powers who have a completely different vision of a world ruled by force as opposed to a world ruled by law. And this is our high concept, and for that concept there can be no end save victory, which is the first hint that defending the Western Hemisphere is not the limit of his ambitions. And there are a couple of other hints in that spring, but then in August, he meets with Churchill at sea off Newfoundland, and they issue the Atlantic Charter. And the Atlantic Charter lays out their plans for the post-war world after, and I quote, the destruction of the Nazi tyranny. That's really an amazing moment because we're not even in the war yet, but Roosevelt has committed us to the defeat of our main enemy. And a month earlier, he had written a confidential memorandum to Stimson, the Secretary of War, saying, I want you to draw up what it would take to defeat all our possible enemies, and that planning to reach that objective is already going on at the time of the Atlantic Charter, and it's finished in draft form by late September.
I hope you'll allow me to take a slight detour. I was fascinated in reading this book over the past week, and you used the word rhetoric of taking the speeches and taking the statements that you used in the book of how the president was building his case and guiding the public to this point. And obviously, we are in a situation, a world situation now, where the world's powers are saying a lot of things, and it seems to often just be summed up as rhetoric. At what point do we start to look at it as more, and even in this case of look at it as that words mean things and that there's great power behind them?
Well, that is a very interesting question. I think that Vladimir Putin's speech immediately after the occupation and annexation of Crimea, in which he gave his view of how the world had been run for the last 20 plus years and what he thought was wrong with that, and indicated that at least in his backyard things were going to be different for a while, that is an example of a speech that has to be taken quite seriously. President Obama is very careful in speech, particularly in the foreign realm. He's very careful not to promise more than he can deliver. I don't think he has the kind of overarching vision of the world that he wants that Roosevelt has. But you have to look at both speeches and what people are capable of and what they're doing. It is our good fortune that we're not living in the world they lived in of totalitarian regimes commanding really enormous resources, huge armies and navies raised by drafts that really can conquer medium-sized countries, leapfrog across continents or across oceans, et cetera, et cetera. That is not our world. And in fact, I frequently feel myself that the real danger we're threatened with is anarchy, not excessive organized force. But all I can say is you have to watch the rhetoric and listen to the rhetoric and watch what people are doing all the time. And in the same way, there's a lot of pretty frightening rhetoric in the Far East being thrown around between China and Japan right now, but nothing has happened. On the other hand, as I say, in 1937, a huge war began there that lasted for 8 years.
You also make the point that President Roosevelt had enormous political and social capital that he had built up during the New Deal years.
Absolutely.
To use to his advantage, which is something that this president does not have.
No, he doesn't. And to me, and I always describe myself as a New Deal, New Frontier Democrat, that is the tragedy of Barack Obama. He came in to office at a moment somewhat similar to Roosevelt, both in the midst of an economic crisis, although the one Roosevelt came in for had been lasting a good deal longer. Now, it seems to me that Roosevelt, master politician that he was, understood he had to bring the American people immediate relief in 1933. and a feeling of greater security. And he did both of those things. He secured the banking system, and then, for various reasons, people were going back to work in 1933 and 34. Thus, he increased his congressional majorities in 1934. He was able to increase them again with a smashing reelection victory in 1936. Now, Barack Obama couldn't do that, and the economic situation continued getting worse, and it certainly wasn't improved at the time of the congressional election in 2010, and as a result, he lost his majority in the House of Representatives to a very hostile Republican Party, and it seems pretty clear that he's never going to get that majority back.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with David Kaiser about FDR and the build-up to World War II continues with a look at the domestic coalition the president was able to build. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1241. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is history professor David Kaiser. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about his new book, No End Save Victory: How FDR Led the Nation into War.
We talk a lot about coalition, and the coalition that President Roosevelt was able to bring together in the country of the nation, labor, business, minority groups, of being able to bring them together to fight a common enemy is an amazing process and also an amazing achievement when you look at it in the whole.
Yes. I really appreciate that you have read the book carefully, Joe, and that you saw what I wanted my readers to see. But he did that, as I say, starting in his inaugural address in 1933 by trying to enlist the nation in this great common enterprise of restoring our economy, of building a new and better America. And he allowed labor to make great gains. He certainly was good for business. Many businessmen didn't feel that, but some of the more enlightened ones did realize that. And he created a shared sense of purpose. And in addition, he was helped because it's very clear that everybody in May and June 1940 was worried about the threat to the Western Hemisphere, so he could draw on that. But again, one of the things that fascinated me about this was the response of the relatively excluded groups in the United States, particularly Negro Americans, as they called themselves then, who were sharing some in the New Deal, but who still lacked basic rights in much of the country and weren't being treated as equal citizens. But their response to this great enterprise was to want to be part of it, to want to be included. And that was the way they approached the war, that they wanted their men to fight in all capacities and to prove themselves. And they wanted an equal share of factory employment, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, I think that probably since another very fine president, John F. Kennedy, we have not had that kind of feeling in the United States again.
Looking at this period from June 1940 to December of 1941, it is interesting because you write about his generals and his admirals, those that are top ranking, coming to him and talking to him about the threats. And ultimately, he is more attuned than they are as to what the threats really are.
In some cases, that's true. And he has a broader strategic vision. The Army and the Navy are more attuned to defending the Western Hemisphere, although one exception to that is Admiral Stark, the Chief of Naval Operations, who I think really wanted to get into the war very early to try to save the British, which Roosevelt did not think we could risk doing in this period. But he, I think, foresees a world war, and he wants democracy to win, if at all possible. And thus, for instance, when Hitler attacks the Soviet Union in what turns out to be really the pivotal moment in the war, in June of 1941, the Army and probably the Navy as well think that the Soviets won't last out the year. They certainly don't want to waste any of our scarce resources on them, but Roosevelt sees that this could transform the whole situation. And if the Soviets don't collapse, it opens up the possibility of the complete defeat of Nazi Germany. And he, therefore, insists on giving them whatever they can to the virtual despair of General Marshall and also Secretary Stimson. I did want to mention, if I may, one other interesting aspect of the way he mobilized public opinion. As you will recall, he appointed these very strong personalities in the cabinet, such as Henry Stimson, a Republican, and Frank Knox, another Republican, as Secretary of War and Navy. And he let them speak out and speak out more forcefully about the war than he was. So that you have, during 1941, from relatively early in the year onward, Stimson and Knox making what amounts to blunt calls that we get into the war as soon as possible in public, even though Roosevelt wasn't allowed to do so. And again, I think it's an unfortunate feature of American politics today that cabinet members very rarely do that sort of thing anymore. The White House won't let them.
And ultimately, when you look at what was accomplished, and we look at this period, what was set up that allowed us victory, as you indicate in the title? Obviously, everything changed on December 7th, 1941. So we were in a fairly, even though a tragic circumstance, a fairly good place historically, militarily, and socially.
Well, we were in a good place socially because the nation was behind the president. We were in a dreadful situation militarily at that moment, particularly with the loss of much of the Pacific Fleet. And we were going to suffer very heavily at the hands of German submarines for, I think, the first 8 or 9 months of 1942, which was the worst period of the U-boat war. But the machinery had been set up, starting in the late spring of 1940, to plan the economy, to plan production, to expand production, and the plans had been laid for maximum production. Many new plants were already being built. Many more were planned. They were using some of the New Deal agencies to stimulate war production. And it's fascinating to me to read about these agencies. For instance, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which went back to Hoover, which was essentially a federal bank to lend money to worthwhile enterprises that couldn't get capital from private banks. We really could have used a replay of that back in 2009, but we didn't have it. And it was being used not only to build plants, but to buy up scarce raw materials all over the world. So we had the institution set up. We had the plans laid. But still, you'll remember this. This is practically the end of the narrative in the book. On December 9th, I think it is, Stimson, the Secretary of War, asks William Knudsen, one of the heads of the production agency, who had been the CEO of General Motors, can we reach our maximum production targets by July 1st, 1943, which was their original goal? And Knudsen says, no, we can't, but we can reach them by July 1st, 1944. And what is amazing to me, as I said, is that that turned out to be the date, almost exactly, at which the major decisive offensives against both Germany and Japan began. Still, though, I mean, everything was hanging fire, even in the first half of 1941. It wasn't clear the Soviet Union would hold out. Britain could be in danger if the Soviet Union collapsed. We couldn't get anything to Europe at that point. But if things went well, within a year or two, we were going to be in a great position. And that is what Roosevelt had brought about.
Ultimately, what do you hope people get out of the telling of this time period?
Well, I think the biggest thing I hope they get out of it is to see how different things could be in those days and how they could be again. And by that, I mean not only the capacity of the country to pull together to solve a great task and to make sacrifices, including 90% marginal tax rates, but to base our public policy on moral values, which is what Roosevelt insisted on from the word go, both with respect to the economy and with respect to the state of the world. And particularly with regard to domestic policy, we are ruled, it seems to me, now by the profit motive. Many Americans think we should be ruled even more by it. Roosevelt, in that first inaugural, said that is what has got us to the mess that we're in right now with 25% unemployment and a collapsing banking system, that we need to operate based on moral values other than pure profit, and he wanted to make sure we would do that. Sooner or later, I think that spirit is going to be revived in the United States, and I'm trying to show my readers what it could accomplish in those days.
Again, the name of David Kaiser's new book is No End Save Victory, How FDR Led the Nation into War. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Well, if you have some trouble wrapping your head around history, maybe you should use a little math. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Generations of historians have debated the factors behind the rise of the world's civilizations. Peter Turchin, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Connecticut, discusses what the application of computer modeling has to say about history's driving force.
Is history just one damn thing after another? If not, if there are general principles shaping the broad patterns of history, we should be able to capture them with mathematical models. But would you believe that a mathematical model can predict with startling accuracy where and when major civilizations arose? Recently, my colleagues and I have developed just such a model. We used a computer simulation to reconstruct the time period between 1500 BC and 1500 AD in the Old World, Africa, Europe, and Asia. We built the model under the premise that large cohesive states with large populations arise from intense competition between smaller societies, usually in the form of warfare. The strength of such competition depended generally on the development of technology like metal weaponry, chariots, and cavalry, and on geographic landscape. We tested our model against the actual historical record, and it was able to predict with excellent accuracy the rise and fall of such great empires as those in Mesopotamia, Egypt, China, and India. These types of models are part of a new field of science my colleagues and I call cleodynamics, after the Greek muse of history. We use the principles of cultural evolution and complexity science to take real-world data and make specific predictions about history that can be rigorously tested using the scientific method. We can even use math to make sense of such events as the recent U.S. government shutdown. Although we can't always predict everything about the future, our research shows that there are general and predictable mechanisms at work shaping the history of our world.
That was Peter Turchin of the University of Connecticut.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.